Good afternoon. I'll call this meeting of the House Finance and Policy Committee to order and note we have a quorum present. Lee Johnson, would you make a motion to approve the minutes?
Glancing through them, if they seem to be okay, I'll make that motion.
Thank you, Lee Johnson. All those in favor of approving the minutes for February 21st, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. They are approved. We have three bills up today, and the first bill is House File 3843, Vice Chair Igbaje's bill. Representative Igbaje, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Igbaje moves that House File 3843 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Representative Igbaje, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So today I'm presenting House File 3843. The purpose of this bill is to require landlords to accept ITIN numbers if a renter does not have a Social Security number. Already, landlords can rent to foreigners based on other forms of identification, and the ITIN would also be added as a legally acceptable identification if a person does not have a Social Security number. In fact, landlords in Minnesota and across the country already use ITINs as a form of identity verification if an applicant does not have an SSN or would prefer not to give out their SSN. Housing is one of our most important necessities, as we've talked about many times in this committee, and it can shape the future for many of us depending on our living conditions. Unfortunately, there is a stigma about using ITINs in Minnesota, and many families that do use an ITIN may have limited options to those landlords who may not keep their places up to standards. And this can be a hardship, especially for children whose parents are immigrants and may only have an ITIN number. As more landlords accept or are interested in accepting ITINs, this bill makes it clear that ITINs are legally acceptable in Minnesota, and being able to accept an ITIN does not mean that a landlord must also accept that application, but hopefully it can expand greater access to better landlords and better housing in neighborhoods where people can afford and where they would prefer to live. Similarly, it could also give access to more housing across the state. This practice should also help property owners fill their rental units by being able to access a whole new pool of potential renters. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative. First, we have Irma Marquez Trapero. Or maybe we'll go next to Juan Luis Rivera Reyes. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, and thank you, Chair Howard and Vice Chair Igbaje and members of the House Housing Committee. My name is Juan Luis Rivera Reyes. I'm a coalition organizer with the Alliance for Metropolitan Stability and a member of the Equity in Place Coalition. I want to thank Representative Igbaje for championing House File 3843. Today I'm speaking in support of House File 3843 as a son of immigrants. I recognize that all Minnesotans should be able to freely participate within our economy and recognize their rights to safe and dignified housing. More specifically, I grew up in a mixed status household. Being a child of immigrants, I know the firsthand difficulties our communities face when trying to exercise their desire to fully participate within our society. As a child, I experienced housing instability for every year of my childhood up until high school, sometimes moving twice within the same school year. Every single time, it was due to the rising cost of rent and the limited options that we had available to us to rent to. These options made finding other suitable housing quite challenging and made it quite impossible in some cases. The lack of ITIN forced us to live in tight conditions with other relatives. It forced us to move to other states to live with other relatives in the meantime. And it caused mental and emotional traumas that we still live with to this day. To this day, as a grown person, the lack of ITIN and the actions that it has caused us to experience in order to maintain a roof over our head have deep impacts in my life. From navigating a rental market that, honestly, growing up did not show me its best, to navigating that own experience for myself now as an adult. The lack of ITIN forces families like mine to live in the shadows and in suboptimal conditions. We know that this is not the desire for many families, as we all just want to be able to freely and legally participate in our society and economy. To wrap it up, thank you for the time and consideration as an individual and equity in place as a housing coalition of BIPOC nonprofit organizations. Look forward to seeing House File 3843 advance for tenants in Minnesota to have more free, equitable housing systems and for us to be able to move forward for all Minnesotans.
Thank you. Next, we have Clinton Rooney. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Clinton Rooney, and I am the founder of Starfish Home Group and the area manager for PRMG Mortgage. At Starfish Home Group, we have a mission to provide safe and dignified housing for all, and that includes people with the ITIN. Over the last 7 years, we've accumulated 41 units, and we serve 27 families currently, and some which are ITIN holders. In our experience, the individuals that come to us with the ITIN are looked at in a traditional marketplace as a flight risk, as individuals that may not stay at the place and may just flee and not pay their bills. And I'm here to tell the committee it's the exact opposite. Throughout my experience, when you're giving individuals the opportunity to have a safe and dignified place to live, they really don't want to ruin that opportunity. So as far as rents being paid on time, criminal activity around the building, apartments not being taken care of, we really don't see that in that population. So there's some items that people discuss with us as far as like credit checks. How do you go about that? And although somebody with the ITIN, they may not have a traditional credit report, there are non-traditional trade lines. So let's say auto insurance, child care, past leases, cell phone bills. By looking over a 12 to 24 month history of those non-traditional trade lines, you can get an idea of a person's ability and willingness to pay on time. As far as criminal backgrounds are concerned, I know that has been mentioned to me before, and we look at it the same as we look at their criminal background using RHR, and if they've committed crimes in the United States, they show up. If they don't, they don't. But as a whole, it's been a very lucrative business practice for us to keep our units full. And the reality has been, for us anyway, we've had a really good group of tenants by doing so. Thank you.
Thank you. Last, we have Ryan Perez. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, Chair Howard, my 65B representative, Perez Vega, and members of the committee. My name is Ryan Perez, and I'm the organizing director at Copal, Minnesota. Copal is a member-based organization aimed at improving the quality of life of Latina Minnesotans. I'm speaking today as a member of the One Economy for Minnesota campaign, where we dream of a Minnesota where ITIN holders can participate as equals in the state's economy. This results in healthier, safer, and more stable communities for all those who call this place home. Our campaign is based out of Mankato, St. Peter, and Medalia, Minnesota, places where working Latin American families have made homes since the betabeleros, the beet workers of the early 20th century. In these towns, we are engaged in an educational campaign, organizing with not only ITIN holders, but also business owners and managers that seek to build a more inclusive Minnesota. Since we launched our campaign this past fall, we have already identified several major property management companies in the Region 9 area, that's the 9-county region around Mankato, who have or plan to update their applications. They will accept ITIN numbers as an equal alternative to the Social Security number. One such company is Atwood Management, one of the oldest family-owned and family-operated property management companies in all of Minnesota, with properties ranging from New Ulm to St. Peter, Waseca to Rochester. After making our case to include ITIN, Rachel, the property manager, realized the change was just good business sense. Of course, Atwood wanted to open the door to more clients. In making this change, Rachel quickly realized the data system they used already had a one-click toggle option to basically to activate it to turn on ITIN numbers because national data infrastructure was already built for the realities of the market. Now Rachel expresses to us a desire to increase Atwood's Spanish language staff capacity, further boosting their economic prospects. I would also like to note that this work engaging renters and landlords is critical. If we do the right thing and ensure access to secure and dignified housing for Minnesotans, including ITIN holders, Gopal and our partners are fully committed to continuing our impactful education campaign to ensure that both renters and landlords are aware of new policy changes. As we continue, we find much excitement for Minnesotans in opening up new markets and building a more inclusive economy. I'll ask you to pass this bill through committee for the benefit of all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. Those are the folks we have signed up. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? If not, we will. I believe there is an amendment, the A1. Lee Johnson, will you be offering the A1?
Chair Howard, members, I will be offering the A1.
Proceed.
The A1 just gives an effective date of August 1st, 2025, so our housing providers and can get forms in place, figure out how they're going to do things, and put a plan in place to implement it.
Vice Chair Agbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Lee Johnson. Definitely understand the purpose of the amendment of trying to have that time to do education. I think as we heard up from the previous testifier, education has actually already been ongoing for landlords and property managers. So I think that that's something that can continue apace. And also as this bill moves through committee, I think we'll be having a larger conversation about the enactment dates that we want to have. So at this time, I'm going to ask for a no vote on this amendment, but we will be coming back to this and making sure that people have enough time to get all the things that they need updated in advance of any new legislation that we put through.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Badgie, I understand why you want to maybe wait to figure it out, but I think now's a good time to start putting a date in there, so our housing providers can start planning to figure out what they're going to do and how to put this into place. Should it move forward? It gives them an opportunity and some guidance on what they're going to have to do.
Any others? Otherwise, I'll move to a vote. All those in favor of the A1 say aye. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. Just two quick questions. First of all, where is this moving to?
Representative Petersburg, this is moving to judiciary.
Okay, thank you. This is the amendment. So I'd like to talk on the actual bill itself.
Oh, I got it. Okay.
Sorry about that.
All right. So we will go to the vote on the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no.
No.
No. The amendment is not adopted. Representative Petersburg, we'll go right back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so the quick question is, because I don't know the answer to this, how interchangeable is the ITIN and Social Security number in regards to reporting to the information that you get when you use that instead of a Social Security? If somebody would know that answer. I mean, I'm looking to see, does the consumer report and the other cover all of the same avenues with one versus the other, or is there some differences there?
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. That's actually a great question. So in doing research on this, and we can also ask, I think, one of the other testifiers come back down too and give more details, but the Social Security number over time has just covered a lot more areas, and the ITIN, which was developed by the IRS some time ago, covers many of the same areas. There's also a lot of data out there and resources for landlords and property managers of how to use the ITIN numbers, as well as other forms of identification, whether it's passports or visas or other forms of government ID that people might have to be able to do the credit checks. And so, and in fact, there are also tenant screening programs that are offered to landlords and property managers that allow both the use of the Social Security number and the ITIN number to get the credit report.
Representative Petersburg.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's one of the things that we want to be careful of, is making sure that these property owners and housing providers have the same ability to be able to track down within parameters of whatever they decide, and each one's going to be a little bit differently to make sure that they're getting the same information using the I-10 versus Social Security, because otherwise, if you need to get some pertinent information and you can only do it with Social Security, then it kind of makes this bill moot as well. So, I mean, that was the question that I had. So, thank you.
Other members, Representative Dotseth.
Thank you, Chair Howard. The question I have is there additional expense to actually use the ITIN number, and then as well as, is this a new way of actually doing credit checks using the ITIN number, or was the process there just really confirm for landlords just to verify credit checks, et cetera? I could see that this could be just more complicated than anything here.
Representative Bajaj.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Dotseth. No, it's actually been being used for a while across the country, and so what they're what landlords are finding and these landlord resource groups are finding is that this is another way to continue to increase tenancy, increase their business. Many of the tenant screening groups have already made it really simple to go back and forth between a Social Security number and an I-10. They also have interfaces that work directly with the applicant, so then that way it's the applicant that's providing the resources and the information needed to do the credit check. But you can get a credit check with the I-10 number as well. And then if you ask for additional identification, you can even, if there's any piece that comes up missing, you can get that more information.
I guess follow up on that question. Is there additional fee for that, and who pays for that fee?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dossett, to my knowledge, there is no additional fee.
Okay. Other members? Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Bajaj, I understand what you're looking at doing here. I do have some concerns. Since this is being televised, a lot of people out in Minnesota probably doesn't know what an ITIN number is. It's a tax identification number for those who do not have a Social Security number, which was given but to the IRS for the purpose of filing federal income tax. It's been expanded a little bit since then. But the problem is, generally you cannot do a credit check, criminal history check. There's not a lot you can actually do with just the TIN number. You have to find other sources to do it, which takes time for our property manager and our housing providers to get done, adding expense, driving up the cost of rent. Now, down here in the last I heard this summer, it was in St. Paul, in this area, our rental units are only about 70% capacity. So you have a lot of open space. In the rest of the state, they're about 99%. We don't have rental units available. And this is going to drive it even farther in those areas where it's harder for those who find jobs in greater Minnesota to find a place to move to so they cannot take those jobs. So I do have some concerns with that. And making it harder for our housing providers to do the checks they need, not just the credit scores, but the criminal history scores and checks to make sure that the people they're providing housing for are going to be safe, which is their responsibility. It makes me concerned. And I think this bill needs a lot more work. I wish you would have accepted the amendment to extend the start date so people have time to figure out how they're going to do this. And just try to make this to work better. I understand the purpose, but right now there's no real good way to verify that it works. If a housing provider wishes to do that now, they can, but I have a problem mandating it, and the rest of the providers who are doing a good service, providing housing for those who need it, at a reasonable cost without driving up costs and driving up rents to possibly lock other individuals out of having a rental unit or a home where they can raise their families. So with that, I'm also going to call for a roll call on this.
There will be a roll call.
Not seeing other members, I'll go to Representative Igbaje for some final words before a vote.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Lee Johnson. I would just say that because folks are already doing this and that there are, you know, products available for landlords and property managers to be able to use the I-10 numbers. I mean, I think as we heard today, it's actually pretty a lucrative business practice. We don't have a fiscal note, so it shows that there's not going to be an additional cost to our agencies, but there also is not an anticipated additional cost to landlords and property managers. I think that this is a good bill to be able to continue to expand our housing market to more people. Again, it's not saying that you have to take these applicants. It's just allowing more people to apply for housing. And with that, I ask for your support. Thank you.
Ms. Erdahl, take the roll, please.
Chair Howard.
Chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Igbaje.
Aye.
Lee Johnson.
No.
Representative Cha.
Aye.
Representative Dotseth.
No.
Representative Hassan.
Aye.
Representative Hussein.
Aye.
Representative Myers.
Nay.
Sorry. Representative Kozlowski.
Aye.
Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Norris?
Yes.
Representative Perez Vega?
Aye.
Representative Petersburg?
No.
The vote of 8-5, the motion passes, and House File 3843 is re-referred to Judiciary and Civil Law. Thank you, Representative Igbaje. Next up, we have Representative Noor joining us for House File 3961. Representative Noor, welcome to Housing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I will move that House File 3961 be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. And Representative Noor, I understand you have the D1 amendment. And before you describe that, I understand that there is just a small typo that we want to fix with the DE1. I'm wondering if Ms. Davis, could you just read that small typo before we move the DE1?
Chair and members, on page 2, line 13, there's a reference to a statute, and the reference is incorrect. It's supposed to be 504B.231. So the motion would be to amend the DE1 on page 2, line 13, delete 504B.321 and insert 504B.231.
I will make that motion. All those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
All right. All those opposed? The DE1 is amended. Representative Noor, to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks for giving me the opportunity to present this bill, House File 3961, as amended. Just imagine that you have packed all your belongings and you're getting ready to go to college or move to a new building. You have signed a lease that promises you that you will be guaranteed a unit that you can move in. As soon as you pay the deposits and everything else, and you're getting ready within a few weeks in a crowded area, you're told that the unit that you had signed for will not be available to you. And just imagine also you're a student who's going to start college that fall. Financial hardship, stress, getting ready for school. That's exactly what happened in my district at Dinkytown Identity Building. Many students who were promised that they will live in a building did not have that opportunity. This does not only happen to the students, as I'm also a resident in that area, because it impacts many tenants who go through the same process. Mr. Chair and members, this bill provides tenants with remedies when new construction for rental occupancy is not available for occupancy by the move-in date established in the lease. One, it provides remedies to the landlord to provide alternative housing, which is identical to the unit that the tenant signed. Two, it requires the landlord to provide reimbursements of the total rent paid to mitigate cost of alternative housing secured by the tenant. Or three, termination of the lease and return to the tenants of all amounts paid. Mr. Chen, members, it also allows that if you are going to go with option one and two, that all related fees be paid back to the tenant. Likewise, I think if the unit is not available within 90 days of the move-in date established in the lease, that the tenant can terminate the lease. Members, this is a straightforward process for pre-leasing, especially when it comes to many units that have left tenants with nowhere to go. Some of the tenants had to pay another unit, so they had to pay twice. That created financial hardship. Quite frankly, they were not even given the option that they can stay in their new unit that they leased because they now have two leases. Can you imagine that? And by the way, at no fault of their own. The imbalance of power between the housing providers and the tenant is significant. And that means we need to rectify that by moving this bill forward, Mr. Chair. So I thank you so much for giving me the opportunity. I do have a testifier on this bill.
Thank you. First up, we have Shauna Tomenis. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Chair Howard and committee members. My name is Shauna Tomenis. I'm an attorney at the University of Minnesota Student Legal Service, where I represent University of Minnesota students in their housing and consumer cases. I'm here to testify in support of House File 3961 and answer any technical questions about the bill. This bill helps correct the power imbalance that exists in new construction leases. One of the things I teach my students in my new renter classes is you can bet buried in that 45-page lease that when a landlord can assign risk to you, they will, especially in new construction leases. One of the more egregious examples was the Identity Dinkytown case, where after students paid their first month's rent on August 1, 2023, anticipating to move in right before the Labor Day holiday, they were told the very next day that the place wouldn't be open in time for the school year to start. They kept the rent, and students were left scrambling in an already tight rental market trying to find a place to live. On top of all of that, they were told they could not terminate their lease. While Identity Dinkytown is one such example, it is in fact not the only recent example of a corporate out-of-town landlord coming to our community, promising a date that they want the place to open, and then falling short of that date and locking students in. When this happens, it leaves renters without housing and with slow and inadequate legal remedies. By passing House File 3961, corporate out-of-town landlords will be forced to meaningfully consider when a property will actually open instead of picking an aspirational date that locks renters in while offloading risk to renters who start the one-year lease term with housing instability. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Ron Elwood. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ron Elwood with the Legal Aid, and I want to thank Representative Noor for carrying this bill, and I'm here to support House File 3961. You know, if a party breaches their contract, can't perform, the aggrieved party really is entitled to fair remedies, and that's precisely what this bill does. in when the shocking circumstances that prompted this bill occur again. And it also provides adequate notice for a tenant in advance. So when the building owner knows that it's not going to be ready, the student or any tenant would be informed, which only makes sense so they can make the appropriate decisions in those circumstances. So I would urge you to pass the bill and appreciate the opportunity to support House File 3961.
Thank you. We do have a few amendments. Lee Johnson, would you present the A1?
Chair Howard, Representative North. The A1 deals with line, or page 1, line 15 on this bill, where it states either cash or check for payment. When you testify, you even said that when some of these are out-of-town owners of these housing complexes, those providing housing, especially for students. And a lot of times they're not based in Minnesota. It's a corporation. They usually don't have cash. They don't have checks laying around. It can take time to do that. You'd have to do an invoice, and it could take 30 to 60 days for payment. So what this does is remove the cash or check and just leaves it as payment. So they could, if they wanted to, they could do an electronic payment, which could be done overnight.
Representative Neuer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lee Johnson indicated, I think this are, absent landlords, so they are from other places. I will say I think the removing cash or check and also making sure that we provide the students with appropriate methods of payment. Some students may not even have, Cash App and other places or even Apple Pay. So we have to make sure that as we move forward, that we indicate that we require the landlords to provide appropriate methods of payment that are acceptable. So I will say yes to A1 amendment.
All those in favor of the A1 say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The A1 is adopted. Next, we're going to move to the A3. Lee Johnson to the A3.
Chair Howard, Representative Nor, members. The A3 takes and strikes language and removes subdivision 3 of this bill. In subdivision 2, there's already remedies put into statute on this by this bill if it's passed. But in subdivision 3, there's more penalties. So it just makes it more precise that this is the penalties. Most of the housing providers do not want to go through this. They want to provide that housing. A lot of times when this happens, it's not the housing provider's fault. It's somebody else's fault that did not fulfill their end of the contract. But we're punishing the housing provider, even when he might not even be at fault. But he's willing to work. And even in the issue with the one that you brought up.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to inquire, is this the A3 amendment or the other amendment, which is A4 amendment?
This might be the A4 you're describing. A3? Okay. Excuse me.
Okay. Yep.
Lee Johnson.
I did get a little bit offline. Forgot to bring my cheaters with so I can read my notes.
So if we're speaking, we could just, since we've introduced the concept, if we want to just take up the A4 now, I think that'd be.
Well, we can do that then.
That's fine. So to be clear, we're on the A4, not the A3, and proceed, and we'll have a discussion on the A4 first.
I don't think the housing providers, in fact, the one dealing with this one in Dinkytown, actually went above and beyond, providing $150 a day, which equals to, if it was their rent, $4,500 a month. And I'm sure that they weren't paying that much in rent. So I think most of them want to do what they can to make it proper, but to not just have So I don't think we need to get into that second part of it, in that what's in subdivision three, and just keep everything in subdivision two, and make sure that the housing providers do have some way to accommodate those if the general contractor doesn't get his responsibilities done.
Representative Nora.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think A4 amendment removes the enforcement that is required. Although the identity Dinkytown made sure that there was some payment, there were some few things that were missing. So this ensures that if there's any violation under this section, that the landlords or the housing providers are held accountable. This is a small fee compared to the $4,500 that you noted, and I think this will be appropriate to make sure that there are remedies and also fines to ensure that people comply with this section.
Representative Dodson? Sorry. Oh, we can go to, if you prefer, we can go to Representative Dodson.
We can go to Representative Dodson.
Go ahead.
Representative Nora, I guess I've got an additional, I guess we're on the amendment right now, so maybe we'll finish up the amendment and I'll jump to my question.
Okay. Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Nora. I'm with this, with both remedies and payments and stuff like that that's required in this bill, and then the possibility of criminal charges, almost criminal charges, or civil. I think it's going up and beyond, and it actually might hurt the amount of people willing to start providing housing in the community, especially around the college area. So I do have some concerns, so I wish you would accept it.
Seeing no one else on the A4, all those in favor of the A4, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. No, the amendment is not adopted. We have two left. We have the A2 and the A3. We'll take up the A3 next. Lee Johnson to the A3.
Chair Howard, Representative Nora. Again, this deletes subdivision 3. Strikes the language related to liberally construed for courts. It makes me really concerned why this section is necessary in the first place, especially when remedies are available in subdivision 2. I'll leave it at that.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lee Johnson, I think I will accept the amendment, and we will remove the subdivision 3.
All those in favor of the A3, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say no. The A3 is adopted. And our last amendment is the A2 amendment. Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Noor, members, the A2 amendment deals with page 1, line 6. Before the comma, it inserts prior to moving in. This makes sure that it is new construction and that it's not for something menial like the sink is, the hot water on the sink doesn't work and it might take a week to get that fixed. It's an inconvenience, but it's not delaying them from moving in.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Lee Johnson. I think this is clear. The definition of the new construction, it's not only in this place. In fact, from the areas that I come from in the human services, if you look at 144G.08 subdivision 42, you will see the same definition for the new construction. So that means it has already been defined somewhere else. But for this purpose, under this section, when you look at the way it's being used, it's particularly for move-in, and it's defined not only as a new construction, but also rehabilitation and other processes where you may end up having a move-in. So this is as clear as it can get, so it's not the only place that this definition has been used. It already exists in the section.
Representative Johnson.
We just go to the vote.
Okay. Representative Noor, any other further comments? No?
I will add to the committee to vote no on the amendment.
All those in favor of the A2, say aye.
Aye.
All the opposed, say no. No. The A2 is not adopted. So now we have the bill, or we have the DE as amended before us. And so any discussion to the underlying bill? Representative Dodson.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Representative Knorr. The concern I have with this bill is I sense that it could potentially have a create a bigger housing shortage at this point because of if a landlord may consider not even entering into a lease due to the conditions that you've got here. Next question I've got is you say new construction, but does that consider renovation? So say if a tenant moves out and the property is maybe damaged and the landlord has to come in and renovate and fix that unit, and he's of course trying to keep that unit occupied as quick as he can, he or she, I apologize, but they want to keep it occupied, but they enter into a lease and a subcontractor can't get in and get it accomplished, so there might be a delay of 1 or 2 days. What does that situation look like, and how do we navigate through those issues?
Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dossett, I think it's clear. There's a distinction between the regular process where you already have a lease and somebody has moved temporarily out of that housing unit. It's an agreed upon between the landlord and the tenant. So that's a different situation compared to a newly moved in, specifically when we're talking about, I think this issue has been highlighted by the identity in Dinkytown, but it's something that happens often when there's a rehabilitation or a new change or any new buildings that you may see. And quite frankly, I haven't seen a shortage of housing coming up in my district. I wish you could have come around and see. There are many new units that are coming up every single day that I walk around. So I think this is not going to hinder at all new units being built, and I think this is much as clear when it comes to the move-in date based on the lease.
Representative Dodson.
So, Representative Knorr, I'm hearing you say there's really not that much of a housing shortage in your community right now. Is that correct?
Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair, members, we have a significant shortage when you look across the board. But when you're targeting the students, I think most of these houses are more based for student housing. We have seen that the need has grown. We've got more than 50,000 students in the Twin Cities University area. So the need is still greater, but I think we have to come up with better options, but because many folks are unable even to pay their fair share in terms of when it comes to leasing a rent around the area.
Thank you.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Neward, quick question. I wanted to get the chronology of this right. When did you say the folks moving in were notified?
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think for this, if I'm correct, it happened on the 2nd. So they paid everything on the 1st of August last year. Okay. And then on the 2nd, they were notified after they made the payments that the units are not going to be available, while the students were supposed to move in by the end of August. So that is clear that they were not even given the chance. No one should have accepted the payments or deposits knowing that the units were not going to be available.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And clearly something didn't work right. But I was reading an NPR article dated September 14th that they were afforded $4,500 a month if you calculate it all out, and I think Lee Johnson did. I got to remember back to my college days. If somebody would have given me $4,500 to go live somewhere else temporarily, that would have been a cause for celebration. I mean, it is a stressful time to be moving in, and then you hit the brakes. But someone says, "Hey, Jim, $4,500, go live somewhere else for a little bit." Things made out of malt and barley might have been purchased with some of the excess fundage. I'm trying to just add a little bit of levity to it. It's an uncomfortable situation, but it doesn't seem like their world stopped revolving because I don't think they're paying $4,500 a month in rent for the apartments at that place. So there was some extra cash in their pocket, and I think that the housing provider provided an over and above to compensate them for their for being put out. But you know, what I know about college students and my time in college is that you're pretty resilient and you don't have that much stuff, so you can find a place to hang your stuff for a little bit, put couple thousand dollars in your pocket possibly, and you're a little bit ahead. I think your approach is a little bit too aggressive, and I'll be voting no.
Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair Knorr. Question maybe for you, maybe for staff, but it talks about notification in there, and I didn't know if this section of the statute defines what that notification is.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll defer that to the nonpartisan staff.
Representative Myers, could you restate that question?
So on line 1.10 talks about notifying the tenants. And I'm just wondering in that section of law currently how that notification is completed.
Ms. Davis.
Chair and members, the way that this bill is written, that would just be kind of a standard written notice to the tenants. It doesn't say anything specific about how the notice has to be given.
Representative Myers.
Thank you. You know, Chair Knorr, hopefully we can maybe take a look at that to define a little bit more of the parameters of what that notification looks like. I hate for something small to cause a potential issue if this were to happen again. So hopefully we can talk about that.
Any other members? Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Knorr, I understand what you're looking at doing here. That's an issue especially around student housing. It deals with the facility down in Dinkytown with the student housing. It was interesting that Bill has 7 days prior to move-in date. The way I figured from what you just testified to, that they were given 26 days notice. A lot of times it might have been that the housing provider's general contractor had to have it planned on getting done, and something happened so they couldn't. As soon as they found out, they took care of the problem. So I think this is more of an issue where it's almost like a solution or a bill looking for a solution. That housing provider went above and beyond, paying well more than what the rent for that month they would have had. Well, actually, then at 30 days, I remember the article, I think they were out for 60 days or something like that. So that was basically 1 month they were out, $4,500 that they received. Plus, I believe there's received other stuff on top of that. I'm just concerned that this bill's going to, especially in greater Minnesota, increase the shortage of rental units. So I wish you'd really consider looking at what could be best, not just for Minnesota, not just for the students, but all of Minnesotans. Because this is, like I said, this is more of a student housing issue, and you're putting it into family housing issues. That could be a problem. So I'm going to have to vote no on this.
So first I'm going to move the DE1 amendment as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say no.
No.
The DE1 as amended is adopted. And before I go to the final remarks, Representative Knorr, I just want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. I know we've heard in many forums from these students who, as you stated, faced significant hardship and stress and turmoil through no fault of their own. And at least for me, when I found out that some of these remedies weren't already available in law, I was pretty mystified that this wasn't already protections in law. So thank you for bringing the bill forward. But Representative Knorr, any final comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you noted, this is not only for students, but for all Minnesotans. It's really important, whether you're in greater Minnesota or you live in the Twin Cities, to have the protections and remedies in the law so that no one, especially when it comes to housing providers, the landlords who are missing, particularly in areas where you have individuals who are students, immigrants, individuals who may not be able to speak English well, who are taken advantage of. This is a great protection that we need. And quite frankly, the remedies that were provided to the students was not enough. They were not given the option to break the lease so they can move to a new apartment complex. And quite frankly, in that area, if you miss the opportunity, right now we're in February, those students are required to renew their lease for fall, for September, in February. It's a significant challenge finding the appropriate place to stay. And particularly in that area when the concentration is high and you're left out, you have to move out of the area. And that puts another hardship by moving back in again when you are supposed to be focused on your education, when you're supposed to be focused on your family and raising kids and everything else in that area. So I just wanted to say thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I ask for your support.
With that, I renew the motion that House File 3961, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say no.
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 3961 is re-referred. Thank you, Representative Knorr. Our last bill on the agenda, we go back to Vice Chair Igbaje.
Okay. Hi, Chair and members.
Representative Igbaje, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Igbaje moves that House File 3844 be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. And Representative, I understand you have an A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like to hear it. Could you briefly describe the A1?
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, today the A1 amendment clarifies that landlords cannot use a pending eviction action to deny a tenancy to an applicant. So as we worked on last year, a pending eviction action is merely an allegation. It is not an eviction. And we want to be sure that landlords will not use a pending case or even a resolved case that has yet to be expunged as a reason to deny someone the ability to find a new place to live. The language includes the type of information landlords should not consider in an application. And there is a rebuttable presumption that a denial was based on information listed above about if it's about a pending eviction and if it can be shown that the landlord looked at those records for a potential tenant and then subsequently denied that potential tenant. Should a landlord be in violation of this bill proposal, the language then lists remedies available to a tenant in the form of monetary damages, such as the return of the application fee and a fine of up to $1,000. This amendment also requires tenant screening agencies to search for and include the most up-to-date information in a report by checking the Minnesota court records online system 24 hours before providing the report. If incorrect information or outdated information is included in the report, an injured party can seek damages or $1,000, whichever is greater, from the tenant screening agency, as well as attorney fees and other equitable relief. So that's the amendment, and we can take questions on the amendment first if you would like, or we can.
How about if it's all right, we'll vote on the A1 to get the bill in shape and then have a full discussion. All those in favor of the A1 say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no.
No.
The A1 is adopted. So Representative Bajaj, I'll go back to you to present the bill as amended.
Right. So the bill as amended essentially seeks to clarify what we enacted last year related to tenant expungements. So the main part of the bill outside of the A1 amendment is that the expungements piece of the law that we passed last year applies to cases that were filed on, before, or after January 1, 2024, which was the enactment date. And I've described the A1 amendment already, so I'll take questions on all parts of the bill.
We do have testifier Cecil Smith to sign up to testify. We'll go to Mr. Smith. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Cecil Smith. I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. I'm here today to respectfully highlight some concerns with the significant changes proposed in House File 3844 as amended by the A1. Evictions are a last resort. They are a terrible outcome for the resident and damaging to the business. Historically, Minnesota's eviction filings have been among the lowest in the country, and that continues. The eviction lab data bears this out. Eviction filing information is very relevant to the next property manager, whether the eviction filing was for a breach of lease or non-payment. Any history of conduct has some relevance to the present, whether our friends find us trustworthy or an insurer considers us a careless driver. Furthermore, this legislature enacted an important consumer protection last session when it required transparency on the part of property managers to disclose all mandatory fees. This information adds to customer reviews on Google and apartments.com. Transparency helps markets function both fairly for the consumer and the vendor. This amendment does nothing for transparency. The proposal now restricts the ability of housing providers to consider important eviction records that are either pending or that did not end with a writ of recovery. This is relevant information, not necessarily determinative, but relevant. When a prospective renter is improperly matched to their housing, it sets them up for failure, harms other renters, and burdens housing providers and governmental and philanthropic resources. This situation should be avoided. These applicant court records provide transparency that is both timely and relevant to the property to which they apply. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, for the opportunity to provide my testimony.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to testify? If not, we can go to discussion. I just wanted to make a comment about last year's legislation. Representative Gaudio mentioned this as clarifying. To be clear, this legislature passed legislation that would keep all of these exact pending eviction actors not public. That was our intent. The courts sent us a notification basically asserting their sort of ability to keep the records public. So this really is clarifying an intent of something that we passed last year. With that, I'd like to go to questions. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of quick questions. You know, the amendment greatly expands what the original bill was, which was just clarifying some of those dates. And so it really expands more than what's there. The only thing I have some problems with just the words that we use and the directions and indicating that you have a presumption of guilt because you happen to have received records that you weren't supposed to have gotten, again, without intent of doing it, that there's all automatically a presumption, seems to me a little bit tough. So if you look on line 1.11, it says there shall be a rebuttable presumption that a landlord is in violation. And then 113 says, reviewed court records related to a potential tenant and records met the criteria described in paragraph A. It doesn't even say if it used that for a negative response or where it got those records. And so I think there's just, I always look for kind of details in the language that we use. And that just seems to be one of those that says if the courts forgot to expunge something or whatever and it came across your desk and you can be verified that you received it when you were looking for it and you then denied it because of something else, you're presumed guilty. And I think that's a little bit concerning, and so that's just my negative thought on it. Thank you.
Representative Peters, I would note it says and, the second clause says, and subsequently refuses to rent or to lease to that tenant, but thank you for your comments. Representative Bajie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Also, the language says it's a rebuttable presumption, so the landlord will have the opportunity to show that they did not use that information in their final determination or that the final determination was based on other information. So there is still a proceeding that would have to happen if it was found. So there's a lot of evidence that would have to be compiled before you even get to this.
Representative Petersburg, anything?
No, that's my yeah. Caution.
Representative Dotseth.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Representative Abadje. Just a quick question is, how will this bill actually bring more affordable housing to the state of Minnesota?
Representative Abadje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Dotseth. I actually think that it can help with ensuring that more tenants have access to housing. Right now, what's happening when we have these eviction records, and they're not even eviction records, I actually really should clarify that. Really, they are court records that are alleging that something happened, or they may be records that are outdated and should be expunged. And so they are records that are from the past that don't currently reflect the situation of the applicant. When those are removed, we can find that people have greater flexibility and ability to find housing, to apply for housing, and they don't have this piece of information maybe from many years ago that would be holding them back from engaging in the housing market again. So it is possible when you have more people able to apply and able to actually occupy housing, you could see prices come down.
Representative Dotson.
Just a follow-up question, Representative Abaji. I don't have the answer to this, but do you know some of the bills that were passed last year, it expedited the process of expungement. Is that correct?
Representative Abaji.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Dawson. I don't think we necessarily expedited the process of expungement, but what we did is we asked the courts to look at cases where either they had been dismissed, where they had been settled, or resolved in some way that did not lead to an eviction, and so that those cases would then be expunged. But it is still an ongoing process that the court has to go through to look back at all those records. And then for cases that are happening now, if those cases are being resolved in a way that doesn't lead to an eviction, they can be dropped immediately if they meet the criteria. So I guess in that case, in some cases, they might be expedited.
Representative Dotson.
Just a final question on that. The expungement process, typically how long does that take as of with some of the rules that were changed?
Representative McBadge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Dotson. So if I remember correctly from previous housing court clinics I've done, the expungement process in the past really required a motion from a tenant, and that would cost money, and depending on when the court calendar was open, when they could see those cases. So it could take weeks to months before someone could get their expungement motion heard. If they fit the criteria that we listed in the law now, then it can fall off immediately as soon as that case is closed and resolved and dismissed, as long as it does not result in an eviction.
Thank you.
Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Representative Abaji, I'm just wondering, can you let me know where did you get the feedback for these changes?
Representative Abaji.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Myers. So the feedback for these changes, actually, a lot of them sort of came from the court and also other attorneys who practice both on the landlord side and on the tenant side.
Representative Myers.
Okay, thank you for that. And then one follow-up question would be on, you know, line 1.8. Just help me define a little bit a court file that's not public, has not been expunged, or has been destroyed.
Representative Igbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Myers. So this essentially, I think these would be referring to probably court cases that maybe the court has already archived on their own. I know that some courts have talked about taking on an archival process for cases that are 10 years plus. If it's been expunged, but sometimes, you know, depending on what the screening report shows, they may be pulling from the past, maybe like a Wayback Machine type of thing. And then I know the courts are also going through a process, depending on the time period, anywhere from 10 to 20 years, seeing if they are able to destroy those records. So.
Representative Myers. Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Badgie. When you did the A1, I forgot to ask an important question. Can you explain what the A1 actually does?
Representative Budget, I think you covered some of that right at the start, but I'll go back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Lee Johnson. So what the A1 is doing, it's adding on to the further intention of the bill about eviction records and also allowing them not to be a detriment and a deterrent for someone who's looking for new housing. So what this is saying, since the courts came back to us and said that they are exerting their judicial autonomy, so this is saying that landlords won't be able to deny an application based on a pending eviction or an eviction that did not res- or a case that did not resolve in an result in an eviction. It's also giving, you know, how landlords can defend themselves if they are alleged to have done that. And then it's also providing remedies if it is found that a landlord has done that. And then the other part of it is it's getting to the tenant screening agencies and the type of information they must provide in their screening reports and to make sure that they have the most up-to-date information. So that way we're dealing with a screening report that is not pulling outdated information.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Badgey, thank you for doing that for me. I'm sorry I forgot to ask that earlier. But I have a question dealing with basically it's from line 1.21 to 2.2. Mm-hmm. On that area, and then it also deals with 2.3 and 2.5. Now, a lot of housing providers use a service to do the screening. Some do it their own, but a lot of them use a service. And the service does something wrong and doesn't follow this law 100% or inadvertently does something. The housing provider can be fined up to $1,000 plus court filing fees and costs and reasonable attorney's fees to enforce the remedy. So that could be easily a couple $1,000s. So what, can you tell me why, if the tenant falsifies the record, they only have to pay a $500 fine? Shouldn't it be the same? Because in 2.3 to 2.5, if the tenant gives false information, the current law is only a $500 fine.
Representative Badgey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Lee Johnson. So I just want to be clear that this remedy is going back specifically to the information that the landlord uses. And I think your question is saying if they're receiving inadvertent information that they may not know about, why is their fee higher than a prospective tenant who provides false information? I mean, I think that, you know, that's a great question. I think we can take a look at that. But I would say that on instinct, it's really we want the those who are kind of at the upper hand in the contract to be able to be at most risk for making sure that they're getting it right. Landlords are providing a service. They're providing housing for folks, and they need to be held to the highest standards to make sure that they're meeting all of their obligations.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Badgey. Generally, housing providers do that. But they also have a huge responsibility in making sure that their tenants are safe. Now, a prospective tenant falsifies the information so things don't come back on a criminal history score or a check where they could actually be a registered offender. And there's kids there. Don't you think it would be wise to that the penalties are the same instead of less? Because that housing provider is also held liable if something happens to one of those kids. I'm going to have to vote no on this bill. It's too one-sided.
I will go to Representative Badgey for any final comments on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. Again, I think this is just a bill that is letting us know that, you know, these records, especially if they're just an allegation of something that could lead to eviction and they did not end up being eviction, should not follow a person around for many, many years like they currently were in Minnesota, and we're trying to address that. So I ask for your support as we continue to move this forward.
So with that, I'll renew Representative Badgey's motion that House File 3844 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say no.
No.
The motion carries and the bill is on its way. With that, members, that concludes our business. We are adjourned.